Welcome. This is the Leaders Commute podcast brought to you by Acuity Business Consulting and produced by Business Radio X. I'm Jess Villegas, and we're coming to you from the Subaru of Gwinnett studio inside the Gas South Convention Center in Duluth, Georgia. The Leaders Commute podcast reflects on the dynamic of recalling past experiences that persistently return to us over the commute of our lives and prompt us to acknowledge their influence on how we think about business and leadership today. The commute theme is intentional. Past episodes have referred to what we have collected, delivered, and mapped in our life's journey. Today's episode, The Blind Leading the Dined, addresses the potential blind spots in the vehicles we choose to drive to our objectives. My guest today is my friend and colleague, Justin Kalvitz, president of Spatula Consulting. Justin will join us shortly to brainstorm on some of the concepts I will present today. Welcome, Justin. Let's get started. Thank you for listening, and perhaps you're even doing so on your actual commute. In a recently constructed thought experiment, I set out to test my aptitude for displaying compassion and providing measured responses while engaged in tense interactions with other individuals. In it, another businessman and I bump each other at a busy airport. I decided it was an accident, and I just kept moving. But he whips around and says, "Hey, what's your problem?" I barely get to three on my 10-count calming regimen before I blurt out, "I don't have a problem. What's your problem?" He gave me a long stare. Well, let me tell you. As a business leader, my uncomfortableness with ambiguity leads me to prematurely escape to unsubstantiated states of certainty, which leads to fixed and unassailable positions toward others who are doing the same thing. Surely you can see this puts us at risk, high risk for conflict. I thought about what a constructive response would be in this situation, but what came out was, "Yeah, well, don't let it happen again." Thought experiment results? Back to the drawing board. I have a couple of stories I'd like to share with you today. The first is titled The Fortune 500. My position as an accounting clerk, my first real job, and one that was lovingly foisted on me by my CFO uncle just after I told him I was planning to get a philosophy degree and teach, had finally run its course. I needed to make more money to support my young and growing family, so I applied to a cost accounting position for a manufacturing company that built reflective direction signs for the California highway system. My weekly compensation at the time was $200 per week or $5 an hour. I wasn't sure what the pay was for this new position, but it was clearly one of more responsibility, and so I was pleased when I received a call from the CFO, Mr. Cunningham, for a job interview. To prepare, I reflected on what hourly rate would be acceptable in the event I was offered a job on the spot. A $7 an hour rate would equate to a weekly compensation of $280. Thinking that might be a little too aggressive, I decided I would accept $6 an hour. The interview ran really well. After our initial discussions, I was escorted on a long tour of the operations. I was introduced to potential coworkers and shown the desk of the recently retired cost accountant, presumably because this is where I would be situated. Everything was pointing to an immediate job offer. I deduced that Mr. Cunningham, who struck me as underwhelming as CFO and a little out of his element, was the brother of the president of the company. After our operations tour, he continued nervously with idle chatter and small talk, much more than seemed necessary given our advanced stage in the process. As I waited for him to gather his thoughts, I worked through a mental rehearsal of how I would respond once the offer came. Nothing less than $6. Nothing less than $6. Nothing less than, "Okay, well," Mr. Cunningham began, "I would like to offer you the job. I have given this a lot of consideration, and I am prepared to offer you $4 an hour." I'd hoped the complete shock and disappointment of this offer was not evident on my face, but I was prepared. "Mr. Cunningham, I appreciate your time, and I really like the operation and the opportunity, but I'm just afraid I will not be able to accept that offer." He'd been looking down at his feet when he made the offer, but he was now sitting erect, looking at me as if I had no head. "What's that?" he said incredulously. This raised my ire, and my inside voice was screaming, "Why on earth would I take a job for $2 an hour less than I'm earning now?" But I remained professional, and I stated again that I was appreciative of his time. He stood abruptly, took a couple of steps away, and scratched his head. I was still very new to the negotiation game, and I wondered if I'd made a misstep or done something to offend him. He stepped back to his chair, sat down, and opened his desk drawer. He closed it, and then he opened it again. Thumbing a dog-eared piece of paper, he looked behind him as if searching for approval or maybe just some help. Then he gave a big sigh and stared off to somewhere else. I began to stand. Okay, his head shaking, he began again. I'm prepared to offer $400 per week, and then in 6 months, I will increase it to $500 per week. It was now evident that he'd originally intended to offer $400 per week, not $4 per hour. Shocked that I did not accept it, he then offered a further inducement to $500 per week in 6 months. After some obligatory hesitancy, I responded that I could indeed accept the offer. Excellent, excellent, Jess. Someone from my office will call you later today for the next steps. We shook on it, and I stood quickly and scurried before he changed his mind. I was giddy. $500 per week, $12.50 per hour, was a fortune. In my second story, Spanish Flight, our Aeromexico flight from the El Bajío region of central Mexico was moving into its last hour of our trip back home to Atlanta when the stewardess passed by with a final round of refreshments. ¿Algo para tomar? Something to drink? Agua sin hielo, por favor. Water, no ice, please. The businessman next to me, Mr. Patterson was his name, took advantage of my break from the laptop to ask me what line of work I was in. I am a business performance consultant and fractional executive. For the next 45 minutes, we had a very pleasant conversation about doing business in the United States versus Mexico, the dynamics of our respective industries, travel for business and pleasure, and family life. My position at the time was a VP of operations for a pet products company based in Chicago. Besides managing operations in the U.S., I visited Mexico for 1 week every month to check on our operations there. My travel preparations needed to be exacting. Living in Atlanta, keeping a residence in Chicago, and traveling to Mexico provided too many opportunities for distracted focus, lost luggage, and misplaced files. This was exacerbated by the need for me to prepare to do business in Spanish, which was not my first language. Speaking Spanish as a kid, even in Los Angeles, was not an easy proposition. My parents were from Central California, but my grandparents were from Mexico, so Spanish was pervasive in our household. But my parents, concerned we might have difficulties as we began our schooling, elected to speak primarily English to me and my siblings at a young age. Over time, my education and work experiences created opportunities for me to work in various management and executive roles that focused on strategic design, financial management, operational excellence, and leadership development. For all of my career to this point, speaking Spanish was not required for me to do business. This changed when I accepted this VP role. Because I am Hispanic, it was easy for individuals in Mexico to assume I could speak Spanish fluently. But the quick and melodious run-on nature of the language made it difficult for me to quickly process business topics or spot communication nuances in more formal business settings. Over time, I developed a tactic for addressing this challenge. I found that if I opened my conversations in a very slow cadence, I could send a signal that I wanted to engage in Spanish, but I had some limitations. This prompted others to speak slowly back to me, substantially increasing my comprehension of the subject matter. This process, along with my subconscious recollection of the language I spoke as a child, served me well, and eventually I was able to conduct business meetings entirely in Spanish. The only fallout I experienced was during the week following my return to the United States. My English-speaking management team, used to my rapid and confident dictates, would become frustrated at the slow cadence I adopted while in Mexico. After a week or so, things would return back to normal. As the flight landed, Mr. Patterson and I started wrapping up our conversations with the standard farewells. We stood, gathering our luggage, and he finished with, "How long do you plan to be in Atlanta?" A strange question, I thought, but I responded, "Well, I think for the foreseeable future? He smiled. You know, I have really enjoyed our conversation, and I must tell you that I think you speak English very well. Apparently, it was not clear to Mr. Patterson that I was a U.S. citizen, born in Los Angeles and now residing in Atlanta, and so he assumed I was coming into town for business. Thank you very much, I said.
What are your hobbies?
I like to take photos of nature, and I like to travel. What about you?
I love to study languages, I adore traveling, and I really enjoy meeting new people.
Let's go on an adventure.
Let's do it.
To leverage past impactful experiences, I utilize an evolving context methodology. That is, the knowledge and competencies and skill sets we build at various junctions of our career can give new context and meaning to past experiences. Let me explain. On the personal side, I relayed these stories a number of times, primarily as icebreakers and anecdotes, to draw out other individuals and give them confidence to relate some of their personal experiences. From the business perspective, I tended to view these stories as instances of flaws in communication. Sometimes they would serve as preambles to my admonishing of management teams to be thoughtful in communicating messages and asking the right questions. I would drone on about how information exchanges handled too casually or bolstered by too many assumptions could lead to undesirable outcomes. Good communication can be an effective mantra, but it can also be unsatisfying. I felt that labeling anything as a communication problem had the potential to overlook deeper, more complex dynamics. In his book, Seeing Systems, Unlocking the Mysteries of Organizational Life, Barry Oshry describes the various manifestations of system blindness that can handicap an organization. He explains that throughout the organizational system, there are personal stresses, relationship breakdowns, and severe limitations in its capacity to do what it intends to do. As I thought more deeply about some of the components of system blindness, I began to relate them to my stories. Spatial blindness refers to our tendency to only see what is happening in our part of the system, but not what is happening in the whole system, or to see what is happening to us, but not see what is happening to others. I believe this is the dynamic that played out in my Fortune 500 story. Shortly after I accepted the cost accounting position, Mr. Cunningham's mother passed away. I came to understand that she had been in failing health for a long time, but recently, things had taken a turn for the worse, and her passing was imminent during my job interview. In this context, Mr. Cunningham's behavior was completely understandable for the circumstances. Things fortuitously fell my way, but was it due to a communication problem? I was clear in my mind of the minimum hourly rate I would accept and how I would respond if the offer did not meet my expectations. Mr. Cunningham was also clear and not so distraught that he could not construct a fair offer for the cost accounting position, even at its original $400 per week. Everything was clear. The stresses in our interaction were about what was happening around us, not between him and I. I may have ended up at $500 per week because of his emotional turmoil, or the retirement of the previous cost accountant could have been unexpected, causing great strain on the financial reporting. His brother, the president, also likely in emotional turmoil, may have been pressing unreasonably for a quick hiring solution so that the team could move on to other priorities. My context was much simpler. My early career naivete prompted me to over-rehearse my responses, possibly portraying me as an unyielding and difficult individual with whom to negotiate. At $500 per week, with the stresses occurring in the business, I may have presented myself as a bargain to just have the whole process over with. Temporal blindness occurs when we can see the events of the present but cannot see what has occurred in the past that led to them. I believe this was applicable to my Spanish flight story. My first inclination, just before I thanked Mr. Patterson for saying that he believed I spoke English very well, was to respond with some clarifying statement to ensure that he knew of my considerable capacity as a U.S. businessman. My next inclination was to launch into my long, drawn-out story about Spanish in L.A., travel challenges, speaking slowly, etc. I rationalize that if I could just communicate a little better and if he had a little more information, this whole misunderstanding could be cleared up. It was all very tempting. But was there really a misunderstanding? Perhaps. But in a different light, it seems as if communication was pretty clear for the following reasons. Number one, the stewardess addressed Mr. Patterson first and asked in English what he would like to drink. She posed the same question to me in Spanish, and I responded quickly and confidently with all the rolling R's in the right places. Second, we found common ground and agreement in discussing the respective challenges of doing business in both the U.S. and Mexico. In other words, we were communicating and resonating on a similar intellectual plane. No pun intended. And finally, the slow pace at which I communicated, which encouraged him to do the same, made it easy for us to exchange experiences without the need for a lot of clarification. Everything seemed clear, including Mr. Patterson's assumption that I was primarily a Spanish speaker. If anything, communication was so clear and so grounded in the present that there was little motivation to delve into what brought us to this intersection in our lives. There was no good reason to clarify the situation for Mr. Patterson, and doing so would only have served to assuage my ego. These stories reside at the low end of the business problem spectrum. There were no residual consequences to manage, no organizational fallout, no investments squandered, no strategic mistakes made. The spatial and temporal blindness examples presented in these situations were only catalysts for the retelling of some personal experiences. However, the stakes are higher and less forgiving when it comes to business circumstances. Therefore, most organizations will tout the importance of good communication while being challenged to explain how it is achieved or if better communication is really the answer. I began this podcast with a thought experiment in which I was presented with the opportunity to give a constructive perspective on a challenge that a fellow businessman faced. I did not do so well, so I'm going to take another shot at it now. My podcast title, The Blind Leading the Dined, points to a more basic source of what facilitates system blindness in an organization. I label as blind leaders who are not intentional about building capacity for A, seeing events that are operating outside of their immediate scope of vision, and B, appreciating what events have led to this moment. They are not necessarily malicious in intent, but for many, there's a natural tendency to assume that if they cannot perceive a circumstance, it is either not their problem or not their responsibility. The dined are more complex. They can be willing to see a bigger picture outside of themselves. They study an issue, get feedback, and take meetings to collect more information. But at some point, when they believe they have all the information they need, when they become satiated, they shut down and no longer entertain other perspectives. In other words, if they believe that they are full, there must not be anything else worthwhile to consume. The compounding effect of having individuals who are not interested in what is happening outside of themselves consorting with individuals who believe they know everything they need to know inhibits effective collaboration. Viktor Frankl, the Austrian neurologist, psychiatrist, and Holocaust survivor, said, "That which is to give light must endure the burning." I note the sentiment because the work of aligning the intentions of all the key stakeholders in an organization so that the tenets of system blindness do not take hold requires hard work. In my opinion, the work begins with the adoption of an awareness model which encourages deep reflection of personal motivations reconciled with the objectives of the organization. I describe that model as release, receive, and deliver. Leadership must release the extraneous information, lackadaisical analytics, and uninspired effort from key stakeholders so that the finite energy in the system is not wasted trying to manage through unimportant or low-priority activities. This is an important inflection point where the decision is made to acknowledge the possibility of system blindness and a commitment is made to be more reflective about the nature of the presenting challenges. Once the unnecessary is released, leadership must receive what is necessary through recognition of the proper inputs, information, partnerships, and resources to efficiently position the organization to meet its delivery objectives. Finally, having released the unnecessary and received the necessary, Leadership is charged with delivering value in the form of products and services for the fees they charge. One last thing about delivery. I contend that all enterprises are delivering something more fundamental. That is a reputation. Reputation represents the aggregate of great quality, best intentions, trust, dependability, and all the characteristics that leave customers inclined to return. In working with management teams, I took every opportunity I could to open with the question, how well did we deliver our reputation today? Well, thank you for listening. I'd like to bring in my colleague and friend, Justin Kalvitz. And Justin is going to just help me think through some of the issues that have come up for him or maybe share some of his experiences along maybe areas of system blindness. Justin, welcome.
Great to be here. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem at all. I'm really glad you could join me, Justin. Listen, before we get started, I introduced you in the beginning as the president of Spatula Consulting, but maybe if we could start out by you just giving us a sense of your background and what it is you do at Spatula Consulting.
Yeah, so for more than 30 years, I spent what I call sort of the corporate world, having the pleasure and blessing to have worked in everything from Fortune 100 companies and brands to here's a white sheet of paper, go figure out the business and build it up to, you know, the trials and tribulations that come with fixing brands and businesses. I've built, and worked in consumer goods. I've grown B2B, industrial manufacturing businesses. I've also worked globally and even created a product category that ended up being a $1 billion product category that didn't exist prior to my, you know, conceiving it and bringing it to market. About 5 years ago, I got bored, really wanted to try something different and challenge myself. So I started my own consulting company, Spatula Consulting, and now really bringing all the challenges and mistakes that I've made and resources throughout the years and trying to help businesses get to what I call point B. Every company has a different point B. It's not just about, you know, growing the business. It's sometimes about operational efficiencies, it's about new categories, it's about future strategies, but, you know, really trying to be a partner and a guide to executives and leaders through my experiences over the years in working and bringing products to market and fixing businesses and growing brands.
Appreciate that, Justin. I can say, not too long ago, it's been about a year, and I guess for the audience, letting them know that I was working through some branding issues and some struggles around how to think about our product offering, and we were like a lot of businesses, you know, we had a lot of things that were really, really good ideas and all over the map, but needed some shaping up in terms of trying to direct a good amount of energy to the right things. And so Justin was helpful to me in mentoring me through a couple of ideas on what we wanted to try and do with that business, and we continue to work together. So Justin, just maybe we'll open up by what you might have taken away from either the story or the message, or maybe you have an experience that you can relate that maybe feeds into the similar theme here.
I think it's really interesting because I love the idea of taking sort of the personal experiences and relating them to business. You know, I do think there's having done this for a long time and been in a lot of different business environments, I think people, over-characterize miscommunication or label issues as communication issues. And I think there's so many more fundamental layers to that conversation that are really there, from goal alignment to understanding how teams work together to roles and responsibilities. And I think that the issues in trying to solve points of communication and alignment in communication can be much broader and do need to be, you know, looked at from a much different perspective. So I love the whole idea of, you know, looking at a situation and sort of tearing it apart and understanding what the drivers were and how did it get there so you can be better in the future.
Yeah, you know, when I was kind of conceiving of the concept of the podcast and the producer was very helpful in helping me think through what I might want to do, I sort of had this lifelong dream of, maybe I'd write a book, kind of thinking maybe the possibilities of that would be low. And then somebody invents something called a podcast in my long lifetime, and now all of a sudden I've got a platform. And I started thinking, wow, I've probably got about, 500 great stories to tell. And now that I'm in story number 5, I'm wondering now if things are going to start to get a little thin. And the reason for that is because I'm realizing that it's not that I had 500 stories, is I was thinking about the same thing over and over 500 times. And it's really, you know, what are the 6 or 12 or 18 things that have really resonated? And just kind of listening to you, it gives me a chance to think about, we all have a lot of memories, right? There's memories that we have and memories that don't stick at all. So what is it that is really making these more important to me versus others? And of course, all of them unimportant to anyone who's not me. One of the things that I recognize is that these memories would come back just persistently, like for no reason. And I thought, well, maybe they're coming back because I just enjoy the story, you know, or maybe it's a story that is reminding me of something that's a little embarrassing. And when you have an embarrassment, it sticks with you for a long time. But it also could be fun to tell. It could be difficult to tell. But that was one of the characteristics. And then the other characteristic is that when it comes to you, then you realize, wow, now I'm going to do something different than what I thought I was going to do before, and now you're learning from it. And there's plenty of memories I have, like that steak I ate last Thursday that's never going to inform my leadership decisions. So I'm just wondering, as you think back, you don't necessarily have to share any, but would you say that you have several, you know, memories or experiences in either work or personally that might fall into that same sort of set of characteristics for you?
Yeah, absolutely. You look back over a career and, you know, you start to talk about a, you know, over 35, 40 year career almost. Now, there's these points that you start to learn from and sort of coalesce together, right? That have the same business impact, but you didn't see it until you put 4 or 5 of the stories or experiences together. And I always joke with partners that I work with that I've made all the mistakes multiple times over, and it took me the 3rd or 4th time to learn from them. And I find myself when I mentor entrepreneurs or work with business leaders, using those examples throughout history and my time in my business career to say, you know, here, when this and this and this happened, this, you know, this was the reason or this was the outcome. It's interesting that you go back to the same types of stories and the same common memories versus 15 other ones that you could have used to prove the same point.
Yeah, I am finding now that in the references I'm making in some of these podcasts, I kept thinking I had, you know, 12 discrete ideas that I would relate to my 12 memories. And what I'm realizing now is most of them have some similar things in common. You know, I referenced the author today, Barry Oshry, and in looking back on some of my other podcasts, I've referenced him before. And then when I think about the future, you know, there are books and there are some things that I've done that stick with me and I relate them through the materials. But what you come to find is fundamentally at the root, there might only be 5 or 6 or 7 really high leverage or what I call, you know, sort of jugular issues in a business that really can get not necessarily solved, but they can be viewed pretty constructively with a similar lens. So when I think about organizational design, one of the previous podcasts referred to organizational velocity, you know, the speed at which intelligence and information moves through the organization, and that there's an optimum speed that they should operate at. You don't want to outrun your resources, but at the same time, you don't want to underutilize your resources. Those are difficult things to see. You know, one of the things I've appreciated in speaking with you is that you've got an aptitude for seeing that constraints and inability to move aren't only relegated to physical things, things you can see. They're also things you can't see. How well is somebody being led? What's the motivation of those individuals? And because you do a lot of mentoring, I'm wondering if you have some thoughts about what you see in terms of how individuals might be getting in their own way when they're trying to move ahead.
Yeah, I'd say all this stuff sort of kind of pulls together when you're talking about stories, because one of the stories that I use fairly consistently with clients and talking about my background is when I was a brand director at Sherwin-Williams, I had a $400 million piece of business, and I was looking at how do I take that business and make a name for myself. And I was focused on getting amazing things done, and I wanted to create this sort of footprint for myself within the organization. And so I did all these amazing things to take that brand to the next level. The problem was, is I was doing 15 things at once. And if I would have really taken a step back, and it was a huge learning lesson for me, I got them all done. But what really resonated was the top 2 things that I was spending my energy on that everybody got excited about. All the other things that I was working on at the exact same time got done, but the organization, the marketplace, the advertisers, like the community around me and everybody I was talking to could only absorb the top two things that were exciting. And if you flip that to today, I've had all these experiences that sort of stems from that learning. And I flip the script down and you say, well, what do I need to do to get X done? And then what are the things I need to accomplish to get X done? And you don't need to go to four or five things typically. You just need to start with one or two. And so by sort of having these learning experiences throughout my career, but it all stems from that, I've learned to take and talk to entrepreneurs about what do you have to do to get this done? What is the most critical thing? And typically that's where a lot of business owners trip and fall and really are inefficient. It's not that they don't get stuff done, but they're inefficient because they spend time on 15 things instead of really understanding that these two or three are going to be what are going to change your future and change the mindset and change the trajectory of the business. And that's really where, you know, again, I did it wrong for all those years. Mm-hmm. And I can point back to that one lesson when I was a 27-year-old brand director, you know, just taking on the world and trying to get to the moon, you know, with a paper airplane.
You know, it reminds me of a conversation I had with a management team and one particular individual who had some responsibility for running our primary initiatives. And he, you know, he's a very, very, he was really good at it, but very typically about trying to moving every ball at the same time, thinking they're all equally important. And we had a conversation, and I don't know where this came from, but essentially whatever he said made me blurt out, look, I understand, you just described to me that you've got to deal with seven glaciers, and I'm not here to tell you that any of those glaciers are unimportant or one smaller than the other. They're all huge, they're all big, they're all slow, they're all move slowly. I go, but you can't melt seven glaciers at one time. You've got to start with the first one. Now, that, I hope that doesn't get me in trouble with people who think that you shouldn't be thinking about melting glaciers. But right. But my point is that it's really a balance, right? So you still have to deal with the seven or the five or the 10. You still have to deal with them. You've got to give them proper respect. But there are only really a couple of things. And the reason I like to sort of harp on it is it's kind of a, it's a very, very, it's not a tired message. I'm not sure the word here. But it's a message where everybody, of course, intellectually, everyone would say, well, you got to work on the most important things. Well, right. Okay, that's not the art. The art isn't how to say you got to work on the most important things. The art is how you identify the most important yeah. things. And I think the right type of thinking, the right type of reflection, acknowledgement that there are issues out there that are completely out of our view that could be impacting what we're doing, need to be appreciated, need to be sought out. They don't all have to be solved, but they have to be respected. And another, you know, I quoted Viktor Frankl, but another big favorite quote of mine, and I think his name is Stanley Kunitz, and it said, the organization is like a spider web, touch it anywhere and the whole thing quivers. So the question right. is, you know, how close to the center of the world of the spider web are you? And deal with where you're at, but also understand that at some point you or someone else will have to deal with where you're not. And where you're not can trip you up if you don't understand what it is.
Yeah, I think, Jess, that also goes back to your point about communication and communication gaps, because I think great leadership teams have those conversations and merge the art and the science together. And when they have the conversations, they dig deeper and they start to understand and discuss, there's less communication gaps and less blind spots as you filter that information down to the people that are going to then go typically execute that stuff, right? And I think that balances, you can't do one thing typically, you can't do 100. What are the most important things? And let's, as an organization, as a team, as a leadership, as a business, have the discussions to understand what are the most important, what are our resource capabilities based on what we have available to us, and then build a plan around those things. And I think that's an interesting, the web of all those things coming together is where you see great businesses and businesses really succeed and leadership teams really, really thrive and or trip and fall and not do so well as well.
Justin, I know you get involved in various types of projects. Are there any projects right now that you're in the middle of that you'd maybe like to share an experience on?
I've got two sort of dichotomy businesses right now that I'm working on. One is a business that is really struggling to get out of its own way because they don't have that clarity on what they need to be working on. And really trying to pull out of the mud, which it's a interesting dynamic business that's developed around innovation, bringing innovation to market. Whereas the other one is a small business who has a really interesting consumer product. They understand who they are and what they are, and they've just been killing it because they're just laser focused on what they need to get done, and they understand how they're going to win. And so I relate back to sort of some of the conversations we're having of two very similar size businesses, very similar sized organizations, both about built around innovation, and one is thriving and one's struggling because they can't focus or they can focus. So just an interesting dynamic. I get involved in businesses from everything from consumer goods and, you know, new product inventions, you know, people that have built something out of their garage and now they're a couple million dollars and looking to grow, to, you know, billion-dollar companies looking to figure out how to take a brand or a business into new markets, or they may have been around for 100 years and looking to grow, and they have a lot of competition all of a sudden and they're not sure how to navigate those waters. So a very diverse background of things that I'm touching every day.
All right. Well, Justin, listen, I'm going to get ready to wrap up here, but I wanted to ask if you wouldn't mind sharing, maybe if you have some contact information, something you'd like to get out there in case someone would like to reach out to you and talk to a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. My website, always a great way to get a hold of me, is spatulaconsulting.com, or my email address is jkalvitz, J-A-A-L-V-I-T-Z. @gmail.com.
Okay, well, listen, I'm going to close here with another quick little story, and it's never going to make it to a podcast. It just doesn't have enough oomph to it, but I think it's a revenue model that you and I need to be thinking about. So I was at a party the other day. There was a woman there who had brought her cupcakes, and they were wonderful, and they were perfect. And then, of course, she took me aside and was telling me about her business. She just said, I might have to close it all down. I think I have a profitability problem. And I said, well, why do you think that? Goes, well, I'm just not making any money. I said, okay, so maybe you go a little deeper. She says, well, I'm not really sure. I go, well, you know, what do you charge for your cupcakes? I go, you're not charging us, by the way, here at this little party, are you? And she said, no. She says, I charge $5 a cupcake. And I said, well, what does it cost to make them? She goes, $1.25. And I said, are you sure? And she goes, yeah, I'm really, really sure. As a matter of fact, that's a little high. And I said, okay, well, it doesn't seem like you should have a profitability problem. She goes, well, I can't make any money. I said, so where do you make these? Well, in a commercial kitchen. How many hours do you got? How many can you make in an hour? How many people are helping you? How many times do you have to go back to the kitchen? Oh, and by the way, can you scale by buying some materials at a better price, by buying more up front and you can get some inventory? She goes, well, I don't really have any money right now, and I don't have enough people to help me in the kitchen. I said, okay, you don't have a profitability problem. You have a capacity problem and you have a cash flow problem. And she goes, really? And I said, yeah. She goes, could you explain it? And I spent a little more time. So the next day, she calls me and says, Jess, I was talking to our banking person, and I said to them, you know what? I don't have a profitability problem. I just need some cash. I got a cash flow problem. And she said, so the banker started saying, well, he would consider, and I'll start giving her some money. So anyway, I sent her a bill for $250. And I kind of feel like if she calls me again, I feel like I might be able to refer to you. All right?
That would be great. I'm willing to work for cupcakes, by the way.
All right, Justin. Hey, you know what? It's really been a pleasure. Really enjoy talking to you, as I always do. Thanks for joining me, and I'm going to go ahead and close things up. Thank you very much for joining us on the Leaders Commute podcast presented by Acuity Business Consulting. I would like to thank our producer, Mike Salmon, for his work on this podcast and great work that he's doing to promote business in Gwinnett County. If you would like to reach out to me, you can do so at 678-644-9311 or at jess@acuitybusiness.consulting. You can catch a new episode every month here on Business Radio X, or you can find us on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you enjoy your favorite podcast. Until next time, I'm Jess Viegas, and you've been listening to The Leader's Commute on Business Radio X.